Welcome to the North Carolina Reading Service. Today is Friday, May 9th, 2025. Broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, we bring news and information to listeners who are blind and print impaired. Our broadcasts are received from Wilmington to Winston-Salem over specially tuned radio receivers and via the internet at www.ncreadingservice.org. All news is read as printed. Our first hour covers news, editorials, and comments of statewide interest. Your readers today are
Judith Dykstra
and Karen Edwards, and we will begin with a summary of the front page. As you look at the paper up over the masthead on the left-hand side, today in final chapters, David Horowitz, a 1960s leftist who became a conservative author and activist, died at the age of 86. Then in today's paper in sports, sisters reunited with UNC women's lacrosse to chase NCAA title. And then moving on down under the masthead, we have five stories today. So it starts with, let's start with a single column down the left-hand side. There's two articles. NC House votes for lifetime concealed carry permits. And then underneath that, Council okays tolling part of Capitol Boulevard. And then to the right, taking up the other four columns, on the top, NC Senate passes bill allowing guns in private schools. Underneath that, in the center, Vatican announces first U.S. Pope Leo XIV. And then under that, ABC 11 meteorologist gets college degree after 30-year break. And we'll read all of those to you in the next time we have. Let's take a quick look at the weather. Today is going to be mostly cloudy with a stray thunderstorm, high of 80. And then tonight's going to be partly cloudy and a low of 53. On Saturday, it's going to be less humid with high clouds, high of 72, a low of 56. And then Sunday will be mostly sunny and pleasant, a high of 74, and a low of 60. So there we have it. Judith?
First front page article today has a headline, NC House votes to loosen gun restrictions with lifetime concealed carry permit. North Carolina gun owners who want concealed carry handgun permits could soon have to apply only once in their lives if a bill in the state legislature becomes law. The current law requires concealed carry permit holders to renew the permits every 5 years. Under House Bill 674, which passed the House on Wednesday evening, there would be a new lifetime concealed carry permit, too. Holders of that permit would be able to keep it for life, never again having to take another firearm safety and training course or pass another background check. The bill passed 70-42 with mostly Republican votes and with some Democrats objecting to ending the renewal process. Representative Shelley Willingham, a Rocky Mount Democrat and retired law enforcement officer, voted in favor of the bill. Republicans argued that the process was burdensome to permit holders and that some states require no permits at all, something that has also been proposed for North Carolina. Representative Tracy Clark, a Guilford County Democrat, argued against the bill, saying that a lot can happen in the 5, 10, 20 years since approval. Democratic Representative Marsha Morey of Durham, a former judge, agreed with Clark, as many of you like to say on that side of the aisle about good guys with the gun. Okay, that's fine. Good guys with the gun. But a lifetime. There can be a lot of changes, Morey said. So this 5 year is just a check to make sure the good guy with a gun stays a good guy who's confident, who's safe and knows how to operate the gun, does not have any affliction that would be a danger to one's self or the public, she said. Morey said renewing a permit every 5 years is common sense. Representative Jay Adams, a Catawba County Republican, countered that someone can go off the deep end 2 days after getting any permit or license, and the permit doesn't prevent bad behavior. The bill now goes to the Senate, which can choose to do nothing, change the bill in committee, or take it up as it is for a vote. In March, the Senate passed a bill along party lines that would allow someone to carry a concealed handgun without a permit, the News and Observer previously reported. May 9th, 2025 at 1:49 a.m. And so it continues that means that both House and Senate Republicans have sent each other a bill that would change the law on concealed handgun permits to loosen existing gun regulations. House Speaker Dustin Hall said Republicans do plan to take up full permit repeal in this session. He said the House's bill to eliminate concealed carry permits is virtually identical to the Senate's, and they may take up the Senate version because it already advanced. As for the lifetime concealed carry permit bill that passed Wednesday, Hall said, whether we have a requirement for a permit in this state or not, that's still useful for folks because they get a permit here that they can use in other states. So they need that regardless of whether we have a permit or not, Hall said. Republicans have a veto-proof supermajority in the Senate and are one vote short of that threshold in the House.
Thank you, Judith. The next article, North Carolina Senate votes to let private school teachers carry guns. How it would work. North Carolina lawmakers have now approved multiple bills to allow private school teachers to carry concealed handguns on campus. On Wednesday, the state Senate voted 29-18 to pass the Private School Security Act that sets conditions where private schools can authorize school employees and volunteers to carry handguns. Last week, the State House passed its own bill letting private schools give permission for people to carry concealed handguns on campus. The message repeated by Republican lawmakers who backed both bills is that the legislation could save lives if a school shooter shows up. This isn't a mandate, said Senator Steve Jarvis, a Davidson County Republican and one of the primary sponsors of Senate Bill 280. It's a choice for schools to decide what's best. Many private schools, especially in rural areas, face long law enforcement response times, making on-site protection critical. Democratic senators unsuccessfully tried to amend the bill to limit who would be eligible to carry a gun on campus. The bill passed along party lines with all Republicans in support and all Democrats voting no. There are a number of limits that were run today that were unfortunately tabled, said Senate Minority Leader Sidney Batch, a Wake County Democrat. I think that a number of the colleagues in my caucus would have supported passing this bill because we care about children that are in all of our schools, private or public. The passage of similar bills increases the chances one will be approved this session by both chambers. The legislation comes amid anxiety over school shootings. There have been 6 K-12 school shootings resulting in injuries or death so far this year and 227 school shootings since 2018, according to a tracker maintained by Education Week. Some lawmakers have cited the March 2023 mass shooting at a Christian private school in Nashville, Tennessee, where a former student killed 3 teachers and 3 students. This isn't about arming everyone, Jarvis said. It's about equipping schools to deter threats while honoring parents' desire for safer schools. But most teachers don't want guns in schools, according to Becky Ciartas, executive director of North Carolina's Against Gun Violence. She pointed to a 2018 Elon University poll that found 78% of North Carolina teachers were against arming teachers. She said the bills increase the risk of a tragedy from a student getting hold of a teacher's gun. She cited how in 2024, an elementary school student found a gun left in a bathroom by an employee at Faith Christian Academy in Goldsboro. How could they live with themselves if a private school teacher leaves their gun behind and a student handles it? Ciertas said in an interview Wednesday with the NNO, that will be on lawmakers. Under Senate Bill 280, an employee or volunteer at a private school can carry a handgun on campus if the person has written authorization from the school's board of trustees or the school's administrative director. The person has a concealed handgun permit. The person has completed an annual 8-hour training course on gun safety and the appropriate use of firearms. The school adopts and maintains written standard operating procedures regarding this topic and distributes copies to parents of students attending the schools. Only vetted, trained individuals chosen by the school leaders can carry it, Jarvis said. It's a local control, trusting schools and parents. Republicans tabled several amendments from Democrats on Wednesday, an amendment to limit the ability to carry guns on campus to retired and current law enforcement officers and retired military members who were honorably discharged was tabled. I think that is an extremely reasonable ask if this chamber to make sure that individuals actually who are trained to use guns can actually be there to protect the youngest and most vulnerable in our communities, Batch said. An amendment to say private school employees would not be required to get a concealed carry permit as a condition of employment was rejected with no discussion. I think that we agree not everyone is comfortable with using a weapon, and particularly in a situation where they would be protecting our children, said Senator Val Applewhite, a Cumberland County Democrat. An amendment holding a person strictly liable for injuries caused by firing a gun in school was also tabled. The good guy with the gun is responsible, doesn't leave it in the bathroom, doesn't leave it in his desk, doesn't let somebody else get a hold of it, and when they shoot it, they're sure of where they're shooting, said Senator Terrence Everett, a Granville County Democrat. Judith?
This next front page article has a headline, Raleigh City Council reluctantly endorses making part of U.S. 1 a toll road. The Raleigh City Council has endorsed charging tolls on Capitol Boulevard between Interstate 540 and Wake Forest, but as some council members made clear, not enthusiastically. The tolls will allow the NC Department of Transportation to accelerate plans to turn the congested four-lane road into a six-lane expressway with interchanges instead of traffic lights. Without tolls, NCDOT doesn't anticipate having money to begin building the expressway until 2031, a decade later than originally planned. Rising costs and competition from other projects across the state forced the delay, NCDOT officials say. The latest estimate is that converting 10 miles of Capital U.S. 1 to an expressway would cost $1.34 billion. With what's going on in Western North Carolina, that really is just a projection, said City Transportation Planning Manager Kenneth Ritchie, referring to the rebuilding after Hurricane Helene. Certainly, costs will continue to increase and impact this project the longer that it draws out. Under the option backed by the City Council on Tuesday, construction could begin in 2027 and be completed by early 2033. There are implications to saying no, Councilmember Mitchell Silver said. Doing nothing will be unsustainable long term. The tolls would be collected by the NC Turnpike Authority, a branch of NCDOT. At the request of regional transportation planners, the authority studied tolling and presented four scenarios, all four of which would result in the six-lane limited-access highway. Scenario 1, tolling the entire 10-mile stretch from I-540 north through Wake Forest as a standalone toll road would raise an estimated $800 million. Scenario 2, tolling the entire 10 miles, but adding it to the NC Turnpike system, which would allow the state to borrow more money, would generate an estimated $1.4 billion. Scenario 3, build and toll one express lane in each direction again as a standalone toll road. The existing four-lane road would remain free, would raise an estimated $100 million. Scenario 4, build and toll one express lane in each direction and add them to the NC Turnpike system. With the additional borrowing power, the lanes would generate an estimated $600 million. Scenarios 1, 2, and 4 would require some changes in state law by the General Assembly, while Scenario 3 does not. The Turnpike Authority didn't provide specific toll costs, but said the rates for a fully tolled expressway would be similar to what drivers pay to use the Triangle Expressway in southern Wake County. This year, drivers with an NC Quick Pass pay about 23 cents a mile, though the rates rise a bit each year. The toll rates for the express lanes would vary during the day depending on traffic. The City Council voted 7-1 to back Scenario 2, in part because it would generate the most money. Opposing tolls was Megan Payton, whose district straddles Capitol Boulevard north of I-540, and who said her constituents are generally opposed to the expressway itself. When I've taken this out to the community, every resident I've spoken to understands that no toll means no build, Patton said. And for them, that seems to resonate as being the better option than any of the tolled scenarios. Patton understood, though, that the council would back tolls and the expressway. She urged that the tolls be cheaper at night or off-peak hours and the road be designed to accommodate bus rapid transit in the future. At-large council member Jonathan Lambert-Melton indicated that he'd also heard from residents who questioned tolling the road. Lambert-Melton said he believed the project would move ahead with tolls anyway, and that it was more a matter of which scenario the council wanted to endorse. People keep saying, why do you want to put tolls on Capitol Boulevard? This is the NC Department of Transportation, he said. This is not any of us saying, let's go ahead and add toll lanes to a city road or anything like that. The council's endorsement will be passed on to the Capital Area Metropolitan Planning Organization, which does transportation planning. The CAMPO board, which includes representatives from cities, towns, and counties in and around Wake County, will make the final decision on whether to ask the Turnpike Authority to toll Capitol Boulevard.
ABC 11 meteorologist gets college degree after 30-year break. This is by Josh Schaefer. Long ago in Iowa, Don Schweniger left college early and took his first job in TV news, where he stumbled into once-a-week weather forecasts, despite knowing zero about meteorology. That lucky accident led to his first full-time forecasting job in New Mexico, where he learned weather science by taking a correspondence course, watching VHS tapes sent in the mail. Sealed and certified, he moved on to Pittsburgh and Chicago. 3 decades later, Schweniger earned his way to chief meteorologist at ABC 11 in Raleigh, where he is often voted the Triangle's favorite TV personality, a literal huge success who stands 6'5" with his nickname Big Weather. And college? Life got in the way, he said, and I never went back. But this Saturday, Schweniger will collect the bachelor's degree he placed on a 3-decade hiatus, marching across the stage at UNC Pembroke alongside his son, Mason. The meteorologist asked Mason if he should delay wrapping up until the winter, not wanting to steal his son's thunder. But the pair will walk as father and son, graduates together. He's such a sweet kid, said Schweniger. Hopefully, the cap and gown fits. I'm a giant. I did say to my wife, let's bring some hairpins. Schweniger's career speaks to an era before Doppler radar, storm chasers, or locals on the eights, when TV stations had weather personalities, sometimes even puppets, which was the case for Albert the Alley Cat in Milwaukee and Willie the Duck in Pittsburgh. In those simpler times, it was possible to get jobs without a college degree, specifically tailored to that purpose. In the early 90s, when Schwenecker started out in TV, English majors short of the required credits for a graduation got hired at internet service providers. Given the choice between academics and a job, Schwenecker followed his mentor's advice. "My professor said, no one's hiring. You need to take this job." And though he started out behind the camera in Des Moines shooting sports, he made himself available for anything. If they said, "We may need you to sweep the floor at 2 a.m., I would say, "I'll be there at 1:45. Schwenecker recalled, "If a person is going to give you their hard-earned money, you need to earn it." He had certification from the National Weather Service as part of his correspondence course, and he progressed in his work. College got further in the rearview mirror. Married with three children, he didn't really have time to finish. A regret in the back of his mind, but never a deal-breaker career-wise. Then his daughter, Madison, a graduate at UNCP, who is now working for AmeriCorps on campus, pointed out a program for adults, exactly like Schwenecker. He could take all his classes online and finish in a little more than a year. The only question was his major. UNC Pembroke offered no meteorological degree, but Schwenecker had worked as both a police dispatcher and volunteer firefighter while a forecaster in Altoona, Pennsylvania, so he chose criminal justice. Going back to school, even though online classes, even through those, required missing weekend fun, neglecting the cricket team he follows, and learning how to navigate Canvas at age 52. But he carved out a TV career through pluck, natural stage talent, and hard work, so even final exams proved a clearable obstacle. On weekends, with leisure time beckoning, his family would nudge him into homework. Not in a nagging way, he said, in an encouraging way. One of my research papers that I wrote was 15 pages. Schwenecker didn't tell anybody about his moonlighting as a college student until the very end when he knew he would make it. He did make the Honor Society along the way, which required taking a day off, but otherwise he managed classes on top of guiding the triangle through rain and snow. Earlier this week, his colleagues at ABC 11 gave him cake. This will suffice for pre-graduation parties for the 52-year-old dad. He won't be up late the night before. "I may stay up the night after," he joked. Judith?
And this next front page article has the headline, "Vatican Announces First U.S. Pope, Leo XIV. Cardinal Robert Prevost of the United States has been elected the new pope and has chosen the name Pope Leo XIV. Pope Leo XIV is the first U.S. pope and the second American pope after Pope Francis, who was from the South American nation of Argentina. Thousands cheered earlier Thursday in Vatican Square as white smoke billowed from the chimney atop the Sistine Chapel, signaling that a new pope had been chosen. Bells rang out as well. All of this took place after black smoke had come out earlier, indicating that a papal conclave sequestered inside had been unable to elect a new pope. But in the afternoon sunshine, crowds grew in St. Peter's Square as people eagerly awaited the traditional proclamation of Habemus Papam, Latin for "We have a pope," after it was clear the cardinals had made a decision. Bands began to play before the official announcement to reveal the new pope's identity to the world, where he would appear at a window balcony overlooking the square. Earlier in the day, things were not so festive, as it appeared the cardinals had not at first chosen a new pope. The Vatican said in a news release that the second ballot of 133 members of the College of Cardinals on the first full day of the conclave, and the third, since it got underway late Wednesday afternoon, was inconclusive. Historically, nominees must gain the backing of two-thirds of cardinals with a vote to be elected as a pontiff. But the first round of voting on Wednesday and a second first thing Thursday all failed to deliver a result. Around 15,000 people were gathered outside in St. Peter's Square with their eyes glued to a giant screen showing a camera feed of the chimney in anticipation of the emission of white smoke, indicating the world's 1.4 billion Catholics have a new pope. In past centuries, the process could be very lengthy. Choosing Pope Gregory X took more than 1,000 days, beginning in December of 1268 and not reaching a decision until September 1st, 1271.
Thank you. This article not from the front page of the paper today. NC Governor Josh Stein proposes $2.5 million to help police tackle fentanyl. North Carolina Governor Josh Stein wants more than $2 million of the state budget to fund new law enforcement jobs dedicated to smothering the fentanyl crisis, he said in Charlotte on Thursday. As the opioid epidemic has continued to drain resources, overwhelm court systems, and wreak havoc on communities and families, the number of SBI drug agents hasn't changed in 25 years, Stein said at a news conference in Charlotte's government center. Think about where North Carolina was in 2000, he said. Millions fewer lived in the state. Opioids had not yet caused a public health crisis. Fentanyl, a potent and deadly opioid laced into 7 out of 10 pills seized by officers, wasn't out on the street. The former attorney general and first-term governor wants $2.5 million of the 2025-2027 budget for a fentanyl control unit. Investigators and prosecutors would have a clear mission: smash drug trafficking rings peddling this poison. The state Senate did not allocate the funds Stein wants in its two-year, $66 billion budget last month. He hopes the state House of Representatives will, as lawmakers, continue budget negotiations. To address this crisis, we have to address supply and demand, he said. We have to reduce the number of people who are chemically dependent on opioids. We have to reduce the number of people struggling with addiction. On the supply side, we have to break up the drug trafficking rings that are bringing this poison to our state and making millions and millions of dollars off of people suffering. Our law enforcement officers work every day and night to get fentanyl off our streets, but they need more help. Fentanyl-laced drugs have exacerbated the ongoing wide-reaching opioid crisis in every North Carolina community, some more than others. Mecklenburg County earlier this year reported a 14% increase in white overdose deaths since 2019. Black and Hispanic communities, which respectively make up 30% and 15% of the area's total population, saw a 200% increase. The Charlotte Observer reported on accounts from parents and students of how $7 laced pills disguised as Percocets infiltrated Charlotte Mecklenburg schools as drugs inside schools reached a 10-year high. So far this year, Charlotte Mecklenburg police have responded to 800 overdose calls. That's an 11% increase from this time last year, CMPD said Thursday. With fentanyl, you don't see it coming, but it's coming. It's relentless, and nobody is safe from it, said Debbie Dalton, who joined Stein at the news conference. Dalton's son, Hunter, died in 2016 at the age of 23 after his best friend unknowingly gave him a line of fentanyl-laced cocaine. Dalton has since founded a nonprofit, Hunter Dalton HD Life Foundation, to educate young people about potentially lethal recreation drugs. Stein, as Attorney General, has long supported her calls for more legislation and resources to smother the drug's killing power. Judith?
Next up, this article has a headline, Cary residents could see property tax increase as growth slows in Wake Town. Cary homeowners would pay higher taxes under a proposed town budget that seeks to fund the town's needs while responding to the pressures of inflation. Town manager Sean Stegall said the town's finances are strong in the face of economic uncertainty and that his $508 million budget reflects the realities of an aging community. Cary's influx subsidy era is over, he explained, referring to the period following fast population growth when new residents' tax contributions help keep tax rates low while expanding services. What would a typical Cary homeowner pay in town tax? The budget proposes a 1.5 cent property tax rate increase, bringing it to 34 cents per $100 of assessed property value. The owners of a $550,000 home, the median value in Cary as of February, would see a town tax bill of $1,870. The current year's $503.5 million budget prioritized affordable housing, the environment, parks, and public safety. The tax rate dropped to 32.4 cents, but many homeowners paid higher tax bills due to Wake County's property revaluation, which raised residential property values by an average of 57% and commercial properties by 39%. Also last year, Cary voters rejected a $560 million parks bond that would have raised property taxes further. Mayor Harold Weinbrecht noted in a blog post the budget has no new hires in Cary for a second year in a row. What would the typical homeowner's total tax bill be? Wake County Manager David Ellis presented the county's $2 billion budget this week, proposing a 25 cent per 100 valuation tax rate increase to help pay for the $142 million library bond that voters approved in November. The proposed budget recommends $80.7 million for public safety, with $44 million of that for the Cary Police Department. The town expects to borrow $2.8 million this fall to buy a police mobile command center and an armored response vehicle. Over $16 million is recommended for the Parks and Recreation Department. Had last year's parks bond been approved, the town would have added three community centers and one senior center. The largest chunk of money would have gone to a $300 million sports and recreation center. How can town residents give their input on the budget? Residents can share comments about the budget by calling 311 or 919-469-4000 or speaking at any upcoming Cary Town Council meeting. Public hearings on the budget are scheduled for May 22nd and June 16th. Residents can also text TXT311 or directly message the town on social media to share comments. The budget is set to be adopted at the end of June and take effect July 1st. It also includes a 4% utility increase and a $2 increase to solid waste fees, bringing the amount to $25 a month.
Thank you. The Griffin case will still bring deep consequences in North Carolina. This is by Andrew Dunn. North Carolina just dodged a political disaster. After months of legal limbo and a federal court's sharp rebuke, Judge Jefferson Griffin conceded his close race for the state Supreme Court on Wednesday. His opponent, Democratic Justice Allison Riggs, can now be certified the winner. At long last, it's over. But the road that brought us here caused lasting damage. The debacle injected doubt into the judiciary and may have redefined how close races get decided in North Carolina. We avoided catastrophe, barely, but the consequences will be with us for a long time. What nearly happened? This might all get glossed over now, but it's not hard to see what could have happened. Before the federal courts stepped in, through a judge appointed by President Donald Trump, no less, Griffin's path to victory was real. The Court of Appeals had ruled in his favor. So even a tie vote at the state Supreme Court could have handed him the seat by throwing out thousands of ballots costing good faith. That wasn't a technical challenge. It was an underhanded attempt to overturn the result of an election. Had it succeeded, the blow to public trust in government would have been immediate and severe. It would have confirmed every worst suspicion that judges are just partisan actors. Thankfully, it didn't happen, but the idea is out there now, and it's not going away. There's no catastrophe yet, but we're closer than ever to one. Challenging close elections is nothing new, but Griffin's challenge went far beyond the norm, seeking to disqualify votes using legal arguments never tested in court. It wasn't a defense of election integrity, it was a cynical gamble. The concern now is that this becomes routine. There's reason to worry that we'll never fully return to an election day where the results are clear. The losers concede and the process is trusted. The new playbook may be to drag things out in court, hoping for a favorable bench to deliver a win. Activists on both sides will expect it. While this case was unprecedented, it may just have set a new precedent. And it hurts the party that started the whole thing the most. The long-standing conservative advantage on judicial races is at risk. Over the past decade, Republican candidates built a reputation as serious-minded referees, judges who applied the law without twisting it to fit their worldview. Griffin's case undermined that image, handing Democrats a powerful talking point as they work to flip the court. It's hard to imagine anyone other than Democratic Justice Anita Earls as the forerunner to keep her seat next year. But the deeper worry isn't partisan at all. It's about losing trust in the judicial system, something that's not just an abstract principle. When people stop believing in judicial neutrality, they stop seeing rulings as legitimate. Every decision becomes a political act. They tune out the legal reasoning and focus only on the outcome. That shift doesn't just shape public perception. It warps how campaigns are run. It invites chaos every time a redistricting map is drawn or a ballot dispute emerges. It ramps up the us versus them mentality and turns everything into a nasty partisan fight. It makes good government all that much harder. Once lost, trust is hard to rebuild, not because people stop voting, but because they stop believing that the law matters more than party affiliation. That's the deeper damage of the Griffin case. Even though the challenge failed, it handed ammunition to those who see judges as political actors. And it made it harder for the best justices, the ones who actually follow the law, to be taken seriously. That includes people like Justice Richard Dietz, who offered a rare moment of judicial clarity. In an early opinion, he rightly criticized the State Board of Elections for decisions that likely stray from the law, but affirmed the clear boundary. You don't rewrite the rules after the election is over. That's exactly the right standard, and one of the few silver linings from this ordeal. The State Board of Elections is finally getting the scrutiny it deserves. The General Assembly now has every reason to fix the gaps this case exposed, clarify voter ID enforcement, define residency standards, demand transparency. There's no excuse not to act. This moment came dangerously close to breaking something foundational, but it doesn't have to go to waste, because next time we may not be so lucky. Andrew Dunn is a contributing editor to the Charlotte Observer and the News and Observer of Raleigh. He's a conservative political analyst and the publisher of Longleaf Politics. Judith?
And next up, the headline reads, it's the NC House's turn to present its budget. Here's what to expect and when. The North Carolina state budget is getting closer to becoming law. The Senate passed its budget bill, and now the House is days away from revealing its version of the budget, which will help determine how to spend billions of dollars in taxpayer money and how much to raise the pay of thousands of state employees and teachers. Here's what you can expect will happen with the House budget over the next 2 weeks. What state employees and teachers can expect on raises. House Speaker Dustin Hall said the Republicans want bigger raises for both state employees and teachers than what Democratic Governor Josh Stein and Senate Republicans proposed this spring. Stein proposed raises of 2.5% for state employees. I think we will have better raises than the governor or the Senate. On the final numbers yet, I don't want to get ahead of our chairs, Hall said, referring to top budget writers. But in my opinion, we ought to do substantial raises for state employees and for teachers in this state. I think most of our caucus agrees with that. The Senate budget called for an average 2.3% raise for teachers the first year and 3.3% over 2 years. House wants separate Helene funding bill. Representative Jake Johnson, an Appropriations Committee vice chair and Polk County Republican, said the House wants to have Helene funding in a bill separate from the budget, unlike the Senate. The Senate budget calls for adding $700 million to the Helene Reserve Fund. Johnson said a group of lawmakers will meet next week about Helene to plan for another funding package, which is kind of a disagreement we're having with the Senate right now. I think they put a lot of their Helene funding in the big budget. We would rather keep it separate, and I think there's a lot of advantages to that. One, it doesn't look political when you're negotiating a budget that you've got all this relief funding tied to every other policy decision being made in the budget, he said. I think the timeline also, that if there's federal funds we need to draw down, being able to move faster and being more nimble is easier when you've got a separate budget bill running. So we'll work that out, I'm sure, but that's kind of a big separation right now we're at, Johnson said. When to expect the House budget committees and votes? After the House adjourned Wednesday night after passing dozens of bills over 2 days, not all lawmakers went home. Representative Donnie Lambeth, a top budget writer, told the News and Observer that budget writers continued their work later that night and will early next week, too, trying to tie down all the area budgets. Area budgets are basically everything but the big items like salaries. House Republicans' goal is to reveal their proposals on salaries May 19th, but the entire House budget in front of the Appropriations Committee on May 20th and have the full House vote by the end of that week. This is a change from recent years in which the entire budget document has been revealed at once. Now, anyone who wants to know what the House plan is for funding infrastructure, technology, agriculture, education, transportation, and other issues and agencies will get an earlier look. More than that, changes can be made through amendments, Lambeth said, then the final version of each section of the $66 billion two-year budget will be compiled into one bill. How to have your voices heard? You can always contact your state representative to tell them what you'd like to see in the budget. Both committee meetings and floor sessions are public, so you can attend both, though there is limited public seating. The public can't speak during a voting session, but most committee meetings do allow for some public comments. The General Assembly website lists members' names and their districts, as well as the daily legislative calendar, including committee meetings and locations. If you are unsure of your legislators, your voter information on the State Board of Elections website includes which districts you reside in. Republicans control both the House and Senate, so they write the budget and have enough votes to send it to Stein without any Democratic support. But Democrats may offer amendments during committee meetings, debate on the floor, and advocate for their priorities anytime. every year at least a handful, every year at least a handful of Democrats have voted for Republican-written budgets, and that has sometimes led to them having a seat at final negotiating tables. Four Democrats voted for the Senate's budget with an aim to influence the final budget bill. Things can change on budget timing. Hall told reporters Wednesday that the planned timeline to vote the budget by May 23rd is still a maybe. That's the goal, to have it out before Memorial Day, and I think we'll do that, Hall said. He said Republicans have already agreed on major spending in the budget, but would not make it public yet. The House plans to take a break the week of May 26th.
Let's stop using coal and other fuels of the past. This is by Josh Tavkar, Progressive Perspectives, Tribune Content Agency. On April 8th, President Donald Trump signed a flurry of executive orders calling for the nation to expand the mining and burning of coal, one of the dirtiest fossil fuels. It was all part of a larger effort on the president's part to unleash America's energy. The president has also tried to freeze clean energy investments that were passed through the Biden administration's Inflation Reduction Act. But Judge John McConnell of the U.S. District Court of Rhode Island issued a preliminary injunction against that effort, noting in his decision that the executive branch does not have the power to block spending approved by Congress, or, as McConnell put it, Trump's categorical freeze of appropriated and obligated funds fundamentally undermines the district constitutional roles of each branch of our government. Oil and gas production hit record highs under former President Joe Biden, despite his talk of a decarbonized future. On the other hand, coal, accounting for 16% of the nation's power production, is in steep decline. Trump is aware of the economic decay in places such as West Virginia, where coal production dropped by 60% between 2008 and 2015. That state, where black gold used to be a synonym for financial prosperity, was once a bastion for labor unions and the Democratic Party. Today, the Republican Party mines support from West Virginians by promising them a coal power future. Earlier in my career as a climate and clean energy policy advocate, I traveled to West Virginia to learn about its challenges amid the coal industry's decline. In McDowell County, one of the state's poorest areas, I spoke with three women who worked in child care at a nonprofit serving low-income families. The women opened up about the impacts of the coal decline, including a high unemployment rate, food insecurity, and the opioid crisis. They also spoke about the health issues people accumulated from working in the coal fields, including black lung disease, which has been found to decrease life expectancy by about 12.6 years. While places like McDowell County overwhelmingly supported Trump in the 2016, 2020, and 24 elections, the sitting president's motivation for bringing back coal isn't the people in West Virginia. He wants to catch up with China and its sprawling economy. But while China is still heavily reliant on coal, solar power is expected to become the country's largest energy source by 2026. If Trump really cared about competition with China, he wouldn't be trying to repeal Biden's nearly $400 billion investments in clean energy. Trump also wants to burn more coal to power the tech industry's artificial intelligence aspirations, but coal-powered AI will not save the economy. Society cannot progress by using the fuels of the past. The future of America's energy economy is a serious matter. Executive orders are not going to stabilize the economy. They are only temporary political tools, easily repealable by succeeding administrations. Moreover, The clean energy investment passed under Biden have created more than 400,000 jobs. Four GOP lead senators, Lisa Murkowski, a Republican from Alaska, John Curtis, Republican from Utah, Tom Tillis, Republican, North Carolina, and Jerry Moran, Republican from Kansas, recently urged Majority Leader John Thune, Republican, South Dakota, not to repeal Biden-crafted clean energy tax credits, which received no GOP support when Congress passed them in 2022. Congress must protect federal clean energy investments. Renewable power is already making America more secure. There is no need to go back in time. Judith?
And next up is an editorial authored by the NNO's editorial board. And the headline reads, Six Judges Brought Shame to NC in Supreme Court Race Rulings. 6 months after the vote, appeals court judge Jefferson Griffin, in the face of a federal court ruling against him, has finally conceded that he lost his bid for a seat on the state Supreme Court. But the more significant loser in this case is the state Supreme Court itself and its Chief Justice, Paul Newby. Under Newby, the court previously had demonstrated a partisan slant by reversing rulings on gerrymandering and photo ID requirements for voting. But its conduct in the Griffin case has made it clear beyond a doubt that the state's highest court puts politics before the law. Newby was accompanied in this attempted theft of an election by three fellow Republican justices, Tamara Barringer, Philip Berger Jr., and Curtis Trey Allen, as well as two Republican Court of Appeals judges, John Tyson and Fred Gore. Each of these judges has brought shame to the judiciary and embarrassment to North Carolina. All voters should remember their names. They also should remember another Republican, Supreme Court Justice Richard Dietz, who distinguished himself by refusing to go along. He dissented along with Democratic Justice Anita Earls. Riggs was recused. Griffin's complaint was ridiculous on its face. After losing his race against Democratic Justice Allison Riggs by 734 votes out of more than 5.5 million cast, Griffin sought to have more than 65,000 votes tossed. What should have been tossed was the complaint. Griffin didn't produce evidence of a single illegal vote, and the votes he challenged were selectively aimed at voters in Democratic-leaning counties. Yet Newby and three other Republican justices kept the cases alive and even affirmed it in part. The Riggs-Griffin race became the last undecided election in the U.S. and a national embarrassment for North Carolina. Adding to this legal travesty is Newby's personal experience. He won election as Chief Justice in 2020 by 401 votes out of almost 5.4 million cast. His opponent, then Chief Justice Sherry Beasley, a Democrat, conceded after two recounts rather than engage in prolonged and technical challenges. Yet Newby allowed a spacious and outlandish challenge to another closed court election to go forward despite two recounts. The State Board of Elections rejected Griffin's protest, saying all the disputed votes were cast in compliance with the law as it had been officially presented to voters. In short, you can't change the rules after the game. Federal District Judge Richard Myers said the same this week. He ordered the election certified with Riggs as the winner. Griffin, at long last and at great expense to the courts, Riggs and himself, gave up his shameful refusal to give up. In the aftermath of this case lies the wreckage of public confidence in the state's highest court. The state Supreme Court could have refused Griffin's initial request to block certification of the election. It did not. It could have completely rejected a 2-to-1 Court of Appeals decision that required voters challenged on a registration or photo ID basis to cure their ballots and threw out the votes by some voters who live abroad. It did not. Instead, the state Supreme Court gave Griffin a partial victory. It allowed the votes challenged on a registration basis to be counted, but it required that military and overseas voters who did not submit a photo ID to cure their ballots. The court also approved discarding votes of never residents, usually the children of military service members or others living abroad. Newby presided over those legal contortions to give Griffin a shot at reversing the election's outcome. Griffin's complaint lacked merit, but it was full of danger. It was predicated not on the law, but on the hope that Republican justices would base their judgment on the political advantage of adding another Republican to the court. It might have succeeded, except that Myers, a conservative judge appointed by President Donald Trump, said the law should rule. He found that the State Court of Appeals and State Supreme Court rulings violate equal protection and due process rights, and tossing the votes of never residents without review of their eligibility represents an unconstitutional burden on the right to vote. There is little hope for clearing the partisan pollution that has seeped into North Carolina's appellate courts. Fixing the problem will require an overhaul of how judges are seated, and fixing that problem will require fixing the state legislature. Until then, thank God for nonpartisan federal judges.
Thank you, Judith. Well, we have a little bit of time to look at this day in history. So let's start with a long time ago in 1502. On this day in 1502, master navigator and admiral Christopher Columbus, long considered the discoverer of the New World, set sail from Cadiz, Spain, on his fourth and final voyage, hoping to find a passage to Asia. In 1800, American abolitionist John Brown, who led an assault, 1859, on the federal arsenal at Harper's Ferry in Virginia, that was the main precipitating incident to the American Civil War, he was born in Torrington, Connecticut. That was 1800. In 1860, dramatist J.M. Barrie, best known for Peter Pan, the title character of which is an eternal boy, was born in Kirriemuir, Angus, Scotland. In 1918, American television interviewer and reporter Mike Wallace, who, while on the show 60 Minutes, became known for his aggressive and bruising style, he was born. And in 1936, 7 months after invading Ethiopia and driving Emperor Haile Selassie into exile, Italy annexed Ethiopia as part of Italian East Africa. The purpose of the North Carolina Reading Service is to connect people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is generously supported by the Orchid Group at Morgan Stanley, and we thank them for their contribution. You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, and we will return to our broadcast shortly.